Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the righteous will walk in them, but transgressors will stumble in them. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them, for the ways of the Lord are right, and the righteous will walk in them, but transgressors will stumble in them. It's 2020 for at least another month. And it feels like there's a lot of currents that are vying for our attention, particularly current events. Current events of one sort or one form or another. These events that seem to be moving us as a people, even as a church, in many different opposite directions. But when I look at a text such as this, it seems to me to be saying that, like it or not, everybody lives on a one-way street. And the right-of-way has been determined by the Lord. There is His way, and then there's everything else. It's really not as complicated as we make it. You know, there's a lot of props that we can put up, a lot of things that can razzle-dazzle and confuse, but at the end of the day, we stand before a one-way street, and the question that is before us is, are we going to continue with the traffic on the right-of-way, or are we going to go against the flow? It's the question that has been presented to Israel. In the book of Hosea, God's unfaithful wife, His rebellious child, what will you do? And the believing remnant amongst Israel, as they go in this direction, what will you do? Will you choose the right of way? Or will you too go against the flow? We're going to be picking up our time in Hosea today in chapter 11, right where we left off last week. I want to impress one last time upon you the message of the book of Hosea. So if you take nothing else with you from this, at least you will say, hey, when someone asks you, what's that book about? You'll say, I know. Let me tell you what the book is about. The book of Hosea, the message of the book, would be this. Although unfaithful Israel will return to the bondage of Egypt in Assyria, their faithful God will restore them when they return to seek Him and David their king. That's it. Now, when we began this book, we saw in the first three chapters, God's relationship is presented through the lens of marriage. Okay, through the prophet's unfaithful marriage to his unfaithful wife was the picture by which God and His relationship to His unfaithful people Israel was to be understood. This loving relationship where God desires His people, He cares for His people, but He is jealous for His people. His people who have turned from Him and who are going and seeking the nations and the nations' gods. So in chapter 4 through 6, because of this spiritual adultery, we saw the prophet take us to divorce court. And he was explaining what God's case was against His people, against the people and their priests and their princes. Then in chapter 6 through 11, that familial imagery shifted just a little bit from a husband and a wife to a father and a son. And in those chapters, we saw God play upon that image, and He was explaining to His child that you're going to reap what you sow, son. If you keep sowing to the wind, you're going to reap the whirlwind. You've gone too far and you're not coming back. Now today, in this final portion of the book, we're going to look to Israel's end. We're going to look to where the story is taking us, and we're going to find a child moving against the flow. Pick it up in chapter 11, verse 12. Ephraim surrounds me with lies, the house of Israel with deceit. Judah is unruly against God, even against the Holy One who's faithful. Ephraim feeds on wind, and he pursues the east wind continually. He multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. In these books, as we've mentioned before, the chapters and the verses, those all came later. Sometimes they just don't happen to line up in the best places. This is one of them. So the last section obviously picks up at the end of chapter 11. And God's looking once again. We're still using this father-son imagery. And the image is presented that is familiar to everyone who's ever had a child. It's like a kid that comes up to you and he's got marker all over his face. And he's denying to you that he's been playing with the marker. We had this happen just recently at my house. I come in the room, Judah's gotten up from his nap, and somehow he's gotten into Andrea's pastel oil crayons, whatever they are. Conte crayon pastels. And he's gotten them all over the couch. I'm thinking, that is not coming out of our new couch. So, you know, I sent pictures to Andrea, and I'm talking with Judah, and I'm asking him, I'm saying, all right, Judah, did you do this? No. Who did this? Did Evie do this? No. Mommy did it. Okay. Mommy did this. Should mommy get a spanking for this? Oh, no. Mommy shouldn't get a spanking. And then he starts owning up. Okay, it's me. And I'm like, thank you for owning up. But that's the thing. You got a son here who he's been caught dead to rights. He's got marker on his face, and yet he's lying to the Lord who knows all things. He's being deceitful. He presents himself as faithful and yet runs to Assyria. He's really trusting in the nations. Now, it says here that he feeds on, the word could be, it's more in the context of someone who is shepherding. He shepherds, he pastures, he leads out to the field. And he's putting to pasture wind. He's a wind farmer. And you say, well, how does that work? Well, it doesn't. And that's the point. You know, he is pursuing the east wind continually. He can't keep up with it. He's a wind farmer. And it's not doing him any good. Now, the interesting thing about this, David and I actually talked about this last week after the service. The importance of understanding geography to get some of the images that's coming in at times in the Bible, particularly in our discussion, is, you know, why is the threat always coming from the north or every once in a while from the south? Well, if you understand the geography of Israel, you'll understand that sometimes that's the only direction, if you're above Israel, that you can come from. It doesn't matter if you're the east or the west. You either got one barrier or another barrier you got to get around, and you come from the north. Same kind of thing's going on here. If you were in Israel and you were to look to the west, well, you'd run right into the Mediterranean Sea. So the wind that would come in from the west would be storms, stormy winds and rains and lightning and thunder, that kind of stuff. But if you were to turn to the east, if you were to pursue an east wind, well, if you were to go east, you'd run into a very different kind of barrier. It'd be a great big desert. No one ever comes from the east to attack Israel because there's a giant desert there. And the wind that comes from the east is not wet. It doesn't bring rain or anything like that. It is a scorching wind. You might remember that phrase, a scorching east wind. The east wind comes that destroys all the crops. It brings in famine. Okay, Israel's chasing after that. How? They make a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. They're mixing with the nations, which is bringing down the curses that God says, hey, if you do that, if you make a covenant with them, these are the curses that's going to come. So part of that is the curses that's coming and bringing famine in the land. And in the end, it's going to be the nations that are going to ultimately come and destroy them. They will come like a whirlwind. So Israel is pursuing that which can't do anything for them. And they love it. They are making an occupation out of it. They won't change their ways. They've become completely insensitive to the discipline of the Lord. Verse 2. The Lord also has a dispute with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. In the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his maturity he contended with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with us. Even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. When I was in seventh grade, I got really frustrated at one of my classes, history class, because I couldn't understand the usefulness of knowing your history. Of course, when I'm complaining to my dad about it, you know, I say, I understand math, I understand English, why in the world am I studying history? You know what he told me, same thing your parents probably told you. You know, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Right here, Hosea is saying, don't you know? Don't you know your history? Can't you learn from your forefather, Jacob? Even when he was in the womb, he was against everyone his entire life. The child went his own way. He was a heel grabber from the very beginning. He contended with God when he grew up. You might recall earlier in the book, you know, the prophet's encouraging them. Aren't you the one that contends with God and contends with people? Then you need to contend with these fellows who are going against the Lord. Contend with your mother, with the priests and the princes. Hurry before it's too late. He's saying, remember Jacob. Jacob was a handful. He constantly went his own way. He constantly tried to manipulate the situation so that it would turn out for his good. So whenever he has these sheep and he's shepherding the sheep for Laban, he's out there with these sticks peeling them to try because he thinks he's going to get the ones that are spotted. That's his payment. So he's like, well, how can I force this to happen? Well, here's a way to do it. Everything he's doing, he's trying to do to manipulate his situation until he finds himself in a situation that he can't get out of. He's heading back to the land, and Esau finds out, and he's coming. And he's coming with an army. So he does the best he can to try to arrange the situation to appease his brother. Remember, he's sending out gifts. He's sending out his servants. He's sending out his wives and kids. I mean, he's got this long train in front before he has to get there. But he's left by himself in this situation that he knows he can't get out of anymore. His history has finally caught up with him. He's going to reap what he sowed all those years ago. When he stole the birthright, it's coming. When he stole the blessing, it's coming. So what does he do? He weeps and seeks God's favor. He found him at Bethel. He turns to the Lord. Finally. Finally. It's that place that y'all call, or that I've called Beth-Aven so far because there's an idol in it. It's not the house of God, Bethel, anymore. It's Beth-Aven. It's the house of nothingness. It's the house of an idol. You got that golden calf set up over there. And Jacob wasn't seeking God in that. He didn't have anything. And he found the Lord at Bethel. That was where Jacob's ladder first came down. He sought God's favor. The God of hosts. Hosts is not a word that we use all the time, but I think most of us know what it means. It's talking about armies. When you see the Lord of hosts or the God of hosts, we're talking about a commander here with an army behind him. He's the God of angel armies. Okay, the God of armies. He sought help from that one to deal with Esau and the armies were coming. From there he found his help. So what does Israel need to do? Y'all need to do like he did. Because Assyria can't help you in this. The Lord. The God of armies, the God of your father. From there you can find your help. Therefore, verse 6, return to God. Do like he did. Return to God. Observe kindness, chesed, and justice. And wait for your God continually. Wait on him. Now you think of Saul. Y'all might recall Saul when he was the king and leading Israel. There's a situation he got himself in. He's waiting on Samuel to come set up the sacrifice. So that they can go and take on these armies. But the armies are coming. And Samuel's nowhere to be found. And his men are starting to desert him. He's starting to dwindle. And it's not looking good. And he gets to a point and says, I can't wait anymore. So he offers the sacrifice. And of course, next thing you know, here comes Samuel down the road. And says, well, what are you doing, Saul? You're not supposed to offer a sacrifice. That's my job. He says, you got to wait. Don't try to take the solution into your own hands. Okay? Don't go to the nations. Go to the Lord. Verse 12. Now Jacob fled to the land of Aram, and Israel worked for a wife. For a wife he kept sheep. But by a prophet, the Lord brought Israel from Egypt. And by a prophet, he was kept. That's a strange little comparison. How are we? What are we supposed to get out of that? We're going through the story of Israel, the story of their birth, and we're reminded of how Rebekah came in on this thing. Or excuse me, Rachel. Rachel and Leah. Leah, through whom the four, and then Rachel, the other two, and then you got the concubines. How did he get his wife? He fled. He went into exile. He was trying to escape Esau, so he exiled himself from the land and went and found a wife in Aram, in exile. And he didn't just go find her in exile. In fact, he stayed in exile to get her. For a wife he was kept. For a wife he kept sheep. Remember, he went in 7 years, I'll work for Rachel, but he got Leah instead and said, okay, but you can have Rachel too, work 7 more years. For a wife, he's kept in exile. Not so with the Lord. By a prophet, God brought his wife Israel out of exile. And by a prophet, Israel was kept out of exile. That's Moses, the prophet that took them out. And Moses, the prophet that kept them. That's Psalm 106. I'll read it for you. Psalm 106, verse 23. When you're going through the list of Israel and their many transgressions and many rebellions against the Lord and his leadership, we find that God said that he would destroy Israel. Had not Moses, his chosen one, the prophet, stood in the breach before him to turn away his wrath from destroying them. It's because, verse 19, they made a calf and whore and worshipped a molten image. Thus they exchanged their glory for the image of an ox that eats grass. So they forgot God, their Savior, worshipped the image rather than the Creator. The prophet kept them from going back because he was saying, I'm done with them. That's Exodus 32. I'm done, Moses. Moses says, don't do it, Lord. So by a prophet, they're kept out. And by the prophets, they are continually kept out. See, the prophet comes as the covenant enforcer, the character enforcer, to proclaim the word of God. And so long as the nation listens to the prophet, if they respond properly to the prophet, you know, if he says, look, you guys are going against the flow, you need to turn around. So long as they shuv, they return, they turn, if they start going in the right way, things will go all right. And here's Hosea laying this out and saying, remember, by a prophet you were kept out of Egypt the first time. Here I am again. You need to listen. Otherwise, you're going back. Y'all need to do like your forefathers did. Verse 14. Ephraim has provoked to bitter anger. So his Lord will leave his blood-guilt autumn and bring back his reproach. And this is connecting, interestingly, to the previous verses. There's actually a word play that's going on here. It's going back to verse 11, the middle of it. In Gilgal they sacrifice bulls. Yes, their altars are like the stone heaps beside the furrows of the field. And then he goes to explain about Jacob. But verse 14, the Lord's going to leave his blood-guilt on him and bring back his reproach. What is the importance of Gilgal in the biblical story? You might recall, Moses couldn't enter the land, but Joshua was going to take them. And when he took them into the land, book of Joshua, they had a barrier they had to get past. They had a problem getting into the land. The Jordan River. Lord says, don't worry about it, I'm going to handle it. Rolls back the Jordan River. And when they walk in, he says, but here's what I want you to do. I want you to take up 12 stones with you, and you're going to make a stack of them so that your children in the future generations, when they're asking, what this means, you can tell them of this great deed that I've done for you here. It's a memorial. You're going to set up a heap of stones. So they go and they set up their base of operations when they go to conquer the land in what we know now as Gilgal. That's their headquarters from which they're going to be going out. They'll go out and conquer a place and then regroup at Gilgal, and there's the stack of stones. Okay? Now they stack these stones up here in Gilgal, and when they do that, they also circumcise the men. They take on the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. They had not been circumcised yet. So they stack the stones up, they circumcise themselves. And at that time in chapter 5 of Joshua, God tells Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from y'all. So the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day." And Gilgal just, it means something like to roll or to roll away. It's named after the fact that now the Lord has rolled away the reproach of Israel, the reproach of Egypt from Israel. What is the reproach of Egypt that was getting rolled away? Well, you might recall in Exodus 32 again, after that golden calf incident, the Lord was about to wipe the people out before Moses jumped on the grenade, and he was explaining, appealing to them for on their behalf to the Lord, and he makes this statement. This is Exodus 32 verse 12. "Why should the Egyptians speak," Moses talking to the Lord, "why should the Egyptians speak, saying, 'With evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people." See, God's angry with them because of the golden calf incident. He says, "Out of the way, Moses. I'm going to wipe them out. I'll start over with you." He says, "Don't do it, Lord. What will the Egyptians say that you just brought them out for harm?" You know, it's this insult, this reproachful attitude with which they are looking towards God's people. And he says, and they're going to feel like they're right about what they say. So he brings them into the land and plants them in the land and starts giving them the land. And with the stack of stones, and now that they take on the covenant, he says, they're not going to be able to say that anymore. Because I'm going to deliver all these people into your hands. No one's going to be able to say, "I brought you out here just to wipe you out." Now what's he saying? The reproach that I rolled away at Gilgal is coming back. What's going to happen to him? You're going to get wiped out. You're not going to be delivered from the nations that are coming. They will remove you from the land. And so the people will look and say, "Yep, just came out here to get wiped out." See, I'm not, since you want to go back to the same practices you were doing that got you in trouble in the beginning, then if you're going back to that part in the story, then we're just going to skip the part where I rolled away your reproach too. You can go all the way back. Chapter 13. "When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. He exalted himself in Israel. But through Baal he did wrong and died. And now they sin more and more and make for themselves molten images, idols skillfully made from their silver, all of them the work of a craftsman. And they say to them, 'Let the men who sacrifice kiss the calves.' Therefore, they'll be like the morning cloud and the dew which soon disappears, like chaff which is blown away from the threshing floor and like smoke from the chimney." See, the Lord will punish Jacob, chapter 12, verse 2. The Lord will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. You may recall back in chapter 6, the Lord was lamenting in regards to his people because, chapter 6, verse 4, y'all's chesed, your loyalty, is like the morning cloud, like the dew which goes away early. So since their loyalty, their faithfulness is only temporary, like the morning cloud and dew which goes away, they're going to only be temporary, like a morning cloud, chapter 13, like the dew which soon disappears. He's going to treat them according to their ways. They will not remain. Verse 4, "But I've been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt, and you were not to know any God except me. For there is no Savior besides me. I cared for you in the wilderness and land of drought. As they had their pasture, they became satisfied. And being satisfied, their heart became proud and they forgot me." That's that story from Deuteronomy 32. Again, verse 9. "It's to your destruction, O Israel, that you're against me, against your help. Where now is your king that he may save you in all your cities? And your judges whom you requested, give me a king and princes. I gave you a king in my anger, and took him away in my wrath. The iniquity of Ephraim is bound up, his sin is stored up. The pains of childbirth come upon him. He's not a wise son, for it's not the time that he should delay at the opening of the womb. He's saying, look, there's only two sides in this story. You know, I'm here, I'm as your father, I'm trying to help you. And what he's doing is making himself his enemy. He says, you're making me destroy you, Israel. I want to help you. Where's the king? Where are those who you have requested to be your help? I don't see any of them. There's none who've been able to save you. You're a silly child. You're not wise. It's not the time that he should delay at the opening of the womb. What is he talking about? He's using this description that we're very familiar with because we find it in the New Testament. We're more familiar with New Testament imagery. Those labor pains. I think of the labor pains. Often my mind goes to Matthew 24. The labor pains that are coming upon the nation. This, you know, you're going to have famine and war and disease and pestilence. Or I think of the book of Revelation. These things that are coming upon the world like labor pains. They are, once they start, they continue until their conclusion. It's actually Old Testament imagery. Jeremiah 30 uses it. The men who are holding on to themselves like they're in labor. It's Day of the Lord imagery. Day of the Lord. We think of labor pains. Predominantly Day of the Lord is day and night imagery. Darkness and light. Darkness predominantly. Gloom and doom. You know, and that's because the day, if you're thinking of the Hebrew calendar day, it's not like our day. It doesn't go daylight to darkness. It starts at sunset and leads to light and then sunset again. So the day is presented as this time that it starts with this anger and this gloom, and then this period of judgment, after which the people who go through it are purified and refined and delivered into the rising sun, the time when the Lord brings blessing. In the same way, the labor pains, right? At the beginning, you're having these contractions, and it's starting, the judgment is starting, and you're going to go through it. But at the end, there's the joy of the birth of a child. It's that same kind of process. And what he's saying is, the labor pains have started. But you're delaying at the opening of the womb. He says, that's a silly thing to do. Why? Well, see, that's where life is. Life, the only life available is outside of the womb. It's on the other side of this thing. You're wanting to stay in here. You're not. You're refusing to allow this process to go through. You won't. Ultimately, the question is, what should he do? He should return. When you're experiencing the judgments, why don't you return to the Lord, find your relief, find life? Why will you die? You don't have to die, Israel. The point of this is to cause you to return. The labor pains that have come on you are to lead you to life. So return. And the question is, will he return? Verse 14. Shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol? Shall I redeem them from death? O death, where are your thorns? O Sheol, where is your sting? He's saying they're refusing to return. It will result in their death in the immediate future. Shall I bring them back? Am I going to fix the story? Compassion will be hidden from my sight. Though he flourishes among the reeds, an east wind will come. The wind of the Lord coming up from the wilderness, and his fountain will become dry, and his spring will be dried up. It will plunder his treasury of every precious article. Samaria will be held guilty, for she has rebelled against her God. They'll fall by the sword. Their little ones will be dashed in pieces, and their pregnant women ripped open. It says she's choosing death. She's choosing the nations. She's going after the wind continually. And it's going to get them. They're going to the grave. There's no coming back from that decision. What about the grave? Chapter 14. Return. Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God. For you've stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity. And receive us graciously, that we may present the fruit of our lips. Assyria will not save us. We will not ride on horses. Nor will we say again, our God, to the work of our hands. For in you, the orphan finds mercy. Deuteronomy 10. It says the solution to this thing is still there. Knowing God, perhaps his anger will, perhaps he will relent. Because he can't help it. But we got to come to him. Assyria can't do it. The nations can't save. We're not getting on those horses. We can't even save ourselves. The means, we don't have the means to provide what we need. What we need is only found in you, Lord. It's not the work of our hands. It's not our bank account. It's not the strength of our arms. It's not in any of that. And not in anybody else we know. You alone are unique to deliver, unique to save. And you're also gracious and generous. You love to give to those who, like orphans, have nothing to offer in return. In you, the orphan finds mercy. The Lord decides. Verse 4. I will heal their apostasy. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from them. I will be like the dew to Israel. He's going to bring them back to life. He will return to them. He will restore them. He will renew them. And he will blossom like the lily. He will take root like the cedars of Lebanon. His shoots will sprout, and his beauty will be like the olive tree. His fragrance like the cedars of Lebanon. Those who live in his shadow will again raise grain. They'll blossom like the vine. His renown will be like the wine of Lebanon. Now this is interesting. He's saying, even though all this will take place, even though he set himself against me, even though the nations in whom he's placed his hope will come, and it's going to lead to his end, this son of mine who is dead will live again. It's Luke 15. This son who is lost is going to come back. And I will restore him as it was at the first. You see, not only is he coming back as a people, but they will again raise grain. They will blossom like the vine. His renown will be like the wine of Lebanon. Now, did that happen? Has that happened? The northern kingdom, we don't know what happened. I mean, Assyria came and took them away. That happened. They died. They were not a people anymore. You come to the New Testament, you have Judah, you have Benjamin in the south, you got some Levites in the north, Samaritans. They take on the name of Samaria in the north. They're Samaritans. They're a mix of people. They're not, the tribes of the north. We don't find them again in the story yet. But he says he'll bring them back. He'll heal their apostasy. He'll love them freely. I find Deuteronomy 32 up to here, but I'm still waiting for rejoice, O nations, with his people. Waiting for that part. He's fulfilled all this, waiting for that. Now, if you're in the original audience, if you're living in the northern kingdom, if you got these rebellious yahoos around you, you're faithful to the Lord, but they've gone sideways, the priests have gone sideways, the princes have gone sideways. What are you supposed to do? What is the punchline that you're supposed to take and bring to your fellow countrymen? Verse 8. O Ephraim, what more have I to do with idols? It's I who answer and look after you. I'm like a luxuriant cypress. From me comes your fruit. See, the punchline, the thing that we're supposed... Obviously, they're taking their relationship to the Lord, but that's a given for them. Of course, they have a covenant with God. Of course, they're His special people. He chose them uniquely from among the nations. They understand that. He's trying to tell them, though, but your life is connected to me. Everything you have is connected to me. It's that same imagery you think of the apostles in John 15 with Jesus. Jesus is the vine. The apostles are the branches. Abide in me, because apart from me, y'all aren't producing any fruit. Fruit for eternal life. That's what we need. They have to remain with Jesus in his words and works, because life is in him. They can't go off on their own and find life somewhere else. They can't give us chicken soup for the soul and get us into the kingdom. It ain't there. It's only through the words and works of Christ. Same thing here with Israel. Life is in their God. Separate from me. You go against the flow. There's only one place that's going to lead. You will stumble. You will fall. And they did stumble. That's what Paul's going to say in the Romans. They didn't stumble so as to fall, did they? They stumbled. They went against the Lord. They were judged. But we find the same compassionate God who's determined to heal their apostasy, to love them freely, and to restore them. So you have people like Paul walking around. I too am an Israelite. What about us? Or the latter audience? These guys get taken away, but the book's still around, isn't it? We have a book such as Hosea. What should us, or later readers, what should we take away from a message like this? Or a book like this? A historic book talking to a people saying, you guys need to change directions right now, or it's not going to go well for you. That day came and went. So why do we have this? Well, there's the postscript. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the righteous will walk in them, but transgressors will stumble in them. See, Israel is not a wise son, and they stumbled. They have stumbled because of their iniquity, but they're to take words in return. It says, transgressors will stumble, but the righteous walk in the ways of the Lord, and the ways of the Lord are right. It's interesting. There is a recent realization among scholarship that in the past, biblical criticism took hold, and people got really interested for the past couple hundred years as to the origin of the books, the ideas in the books, and their dating, and we're kind of treating them as individual units. But recently, I'm talking about in the past several decades, scholars started to realize, wait a minute now, the Minor Prophets, those 12 little books, are always on one scroll. And they're not arranged in an order of dating or anything like that, but they're always in the same order, and they're treated like one book. Because they're arranged thematically. Now, certainly there is some chronological ordering, but not all. It's thematically. They're trying to help you see. They want to highlight certain things that the prophets are talking about so that you connect it from one book to the next book, because you're supposed to read them in order. And if you read them in order, Hosea is the very first book of the book of 12. It's like the dust cover to the book. Read this. If you don't read this part, don't even bother moving forward. Because you really need to know this about God and His ways and His people to take it with you into the remaining books. And Hosea is unique in the way it presents God in comparison to the remaining books. Unique in its emphasis, in His relational emphasis, so that you can understand God and His ways and His character and how He loves His people in the same way as a husband loves a wife. So that as I'm going through the rest of these books and I'm seeing His dealings with them, I understand it's not because He is a harsh God or a judgmental God, it's because He is a jealous God. Jealous for the one that He loves. And His love is going to manifest itself in various ways for the good of the people that He cares for, because He's protected. He's like a father. And Israel is His child. His rebellious child. I go ahead, this isn't happening for nothing. When you come to Joel, the next book, and it's saying, hey guys, you need to ask your parents and their parents, if you get grandpappy or great-grandpappy sitting over there, see if anything has happened like this famine that's going on. They've never seen anything like this. You're saying, wow, Lord, why is this going on? It's because He loves them. And He's jealous for them. And He wants a relationship with them for their good. Because He's omnibenevolent. He's the good God. So why should I care when I look at this particular prophet that, unlike all the other of the 12, gives me such a full and illustrative description of who God is and His ways, was because I've entered into the same kind of relationship with Him. Because we are sons and daughters. And those whom the Lord loves, He disciplines. Even as a father, the son in whom He delights. Because we have become the bride of Christ. The bride who's supposed to be making herself ready, beautiful, so that when the groom comes, we can move into this party and delight in one another. And the more I understand then about my bridegroom through the Old Testament, through books such as this, and the more that I understand now my relationship to Him and how it ought to be, despite how it is, the more I can lean into this loving relationship. So that we can be wise. So that we can understand that the ways of the Lord are right. So we can go with the flow for our good and the good of this relationship.